Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. 50 years ago, when Ralph Nader wrote Unsafe at Any Speed, is the time for him to write an edition for pedestrians. According to the National Safety Council, there's been a huge rise in distracted walking injuries, like falling down a flight of stairs. I can't believe I'm laughing. Walking into a glass door, or you've all seen that video of that woman toppling into a fountain. Of course, if you're the product of gene editing, you might be exempt from such mortal failures. Last week, the world's elite geneticists debated the future of humanity in the age of enhanced natural selection. Joining us on the line for these and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan, artist head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the wonderful Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
Dave.
Well, this is unbelievable. I mean, we all know that people do this because you see everybody walking down the street with their head in their phones, but I didn't realize there were deaths and shattered pelvises and back and neck injuries and the woman that fell into 6 feet of cold water in Lake Michigan. So What do we do about this? Do we need beepers on the phones or what?
Those little backup buzzers like they have on the backhoes. I don't know that you're going to do much about it except continue to educate, continue to try and pound home the idea that, I mean, I live in New York City now, so I see this. People are on their phone, and they are just walking into traffic. They're crossing in front of cars and trucks. It's crazy. You cannot – I mean, it would be good to say – texting and walking around at the same time, just like texting and driving, are probably bad ideas. But I don't know that you're going to get people to stop. They're so wired in to their phone, texting, communicating on the internet and so on. Boy, that's a tough one to solve.
Yeah, I have to say, in the grand scheme of things, this matters to me about 1%. Texting while driving is such a horrible epidemic and so dangerous that when we fix that one, then we can worry about distracted walking. And that's my two cents.
You're taking the more Darwinian approach. Once
you're
eliminated, you will.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was going to say, the Darwinian approach. Thank you, Art Kaplan. Speaking of Darwin, what's going on with this conference of, as I said before, these elite geneticists? Every time I read one of these stories, I fear for the future of humanity. Tell us what happened and tell me if the fear is well-founded.
About a week ago, a very distinguished group of geneticists and some lawyers and ethicists, a few patient groups actually too, met at the National Academy of Sciences, which is our leading institution for scientists in the country. You have to get elected to it. It's very tough to achieve that status. And they met to discuss a new technique called CRISPR-9, which we don't have to get too lost in the details, but it's basically a way to edit genes that's very accurate. For a long time, scientists, doctors had said, you know what, we're never going to touch genes that you pass on to future generations. It's too risky. There's too much danger of eugenics, of going back to sort of trying to create the perfect race or the perfect baby. We're just going to change genes in the cells of your body. So if you had cystic fibrosis, we might try to fix it by changing the genes in your lungs, but that wouldn't be passed on. Mm-hmm. We haven't touched anything in your sperm or your egg. Well, with a new technique, people are sure they can accurately edit embryos, and that opens the door to this future fear of trying to design better babies, perfect babies, and passing on cures, I should add, too, to future generations. So you could wipe out sickle cell disease, which is clearly inherited. You could get after many forms of breast cancer. Remember Angelina Jolie's inherited breast cancer? So
right.
She didn't have anything to do except try to remove her breasts and later her ovaries. That's a heritable, easy-to-fix disease, potentially, with this new form of gene editing. Okay, so guess what? The old principle, we're never going to touch genes that pass on to the future, out the window. Bye-bye. Now people are talking about, are we going to use this only to fix diseases, or are we going to use it to try and make better babies? And here I'm going to take on Jim's skeptical role and say, you know what? We're going to use it to fix diseases. There is no way you're going to hold people who have Tay-Sachs disease or passing on cystic fibrosis or hemophilia hostage to worries about the future. Whether we go down the eugenics path, I don't know. But we're going to start engineering kids. This wasn't the outcome of the meeting. They sort of said, let's have a moratorium and think about it. but I don't think they'll be thinking too long.
But, I mean, if there was ever an issue, I'm sure you don't need to hear this from me, for the likes of you, medical ethicists, it seems to me it's this, because what you just said, on one hand, who is going to say we shouldn't do something to wipe out a disease that's going to be passed along within a family? But the flip side is the superhuman race thing. So is the, I mean, I hate the expression, is the genie out of the bottle? The genie is out of the bottle, right? I mean, it's
correct. Correct. Once you have that tool and you can see that it's going to be used for fixing diseases, therapeutic purposes, then it's going to get used. If you're going to try and draw the line, it's going to have to be around why is it wrong or bad to try and make a better baby. And let me add, the best thing about this technique is that it is a full employment guarantee for bioethicists. It's just like, sign up now, kids, for your bioethics courses, because this is going to be the big issue. When someone comes along to replace me on this show, you can be spending a lot of time talking about better babies and perfect babies. But I'm going to go further. I'm going to say this, just to be provocative. I'm not sure you can draw that line around trying to make a better baby. I mean, at the end of the day, if you could do it safely, would it be wrong to try and enhance your memory, or wrong to try and make someone who had a stronger immune system just naturally?
Well, it'd be wrong if it turns out the only people who can have a stronger immune system or build a better baby are people who can afford to do it and everybody else can't. So in that setting...
So let me grapple that pathetic argument. And I tell you why it's pathetic.
Okay.
It's just because it doesn't stop us from doing anything else, right?
That's a good point.
Within my eye shot, I'm looking at a private school down the street in Manhattan that must cost, I don't know, $80,000 to go to. Every kid has their own teacher. I think they massage them at lunch hour. They give them tennis lessons and language lessons. And then, not too far from where you're sitting, in, say, some of the small towns in Malden or Chelsea, there are kids hoping that the building doesn't fall down on their heads and they would like a book.
But you know what, Captain?
I don't know.
I'm interested in what you think, though. I mean, obviously we get the disease thing, as we said, and you can argue that maybe a stronger immune system is fine, but how about, you know, we want taller or thinner or blue-eyed or whatever. You know what I mean? The cosmetic part.
I think it's all coming.
Okay.
I do. I think.
God, good thing we were born before this.
Scoping,
huh?
It's one step up from scoping people out at the bar when you're single and sort of thinking, she's cute, he's handsome.
Yeah.
What you're doing is a little bit of gene detection there. Now it's scientific. So I do. I think it's coming.
When?
We can delay it and we can argue about it and we can even address Jim's concern and try to make it more available in a fairer way. But boy, sort of telling people. We have this technique. Well, I look at it this way. I'll give you another analogy. If you go down to the local sperm bank, if you're a woman
looking for a sperm donor,
they got a book there, right?
Yeah.
And you pull out the book and it says, sperm from 7 foot tall Ukrainian genius mathematician. Or, it's clearly, as long as we're here, why don't we pick some of these traits? And we're already doing that.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. So I guess what's going to happen in the future, we'll be dead by then. But everybody in the rich suburbs, Weston and Wellesley and Brookline,
they'll
gorgeous.
Be beautiful.
And the people in the poor towns will be a mess. I guess that's what's going to happen.
Art, let me tell you, that was very Darwinian of you, whatever that means. Now, Art, can we move to something we've discussed with you in the past that is really distressing? I think the last time
by the way, before we jump, one other thing.
Sure.
Yes.
We'll probably all be dead, listeners and talkers alike, relative to the eugenic future. But what's coming in the short run is engineering animals. And, these techniques work there, too. So look for the better racehorse, the super dog at the Westminster Kennel Show.
Ooh.
We're going to have some issues to talk about on the animal side, I think, relatively soon.
We were talking to Roger Berkowitz, the owner of Legal Seafoods, the other day on the air about genetically modified salmon. I mean, that's a variation on a theme, isn't it?
Sorry, Marjorie.
I was just going to say, what does the genetically super toy poodle look like, or the little Cocker Spaniel? I'm not sure.
Well, look at it this way. Right now, we bred all those things, right?
Yeah.
Exist in nature, and they'd all be eaten if they went outside without a leash or something. But the pet of the future, you know, the micro pig, it doesn't pollute so much. You
micro
can hold
pig.
It in your hand. You could have... Teeny chihuahua. I mean,
by the way, I want to interrupt you right here. I have never told you. Marjorie's mocked me for the 16 years I've known her. my invention, which actually falls, which I knew I could get rich on.
There are so many inventions.
Well, one of the inventions, my entrepreneurial self, was to breed the pygmy cat, which never gets large. So even though it grows old, it's always a little kitten. I mean, is that perfect or
genius.
Is that perfect?
Oh, yeah, sure. Cute.
Thank
and
you.
And flip at the other end, the giant friendly lion.
Exactly.
Who wouldn't want a friendly lion in their house?
Really Darwinian. Okay, let's move on to another really serious topic. We've discussed this with you as recently as a few weeks ago. I hope I got this right. One of the most recent face transplants in the U.S. was actually done at your place, and you
yes.
spoke to the person who was the recipient. Am I not right about this?
Mm-hmm.
And you made a point that I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't thought about before, which is, I had thought about the whole issue about spending all this money and expertise on quality of life as opposed to survival issues. Mm-hmm. There's an ethical question. But you also told us something I hadn't thought about, is if a face doesn't work, if it doesn't take fully, it's curtains. And this is a real serious concern. Well, I'm reading this piece a couple of days ago, and I alerted Marjorie and Chelsea to it, where there appears to be this trend where these face transplants look and work wonderfully in the short run, and then they age and almost disintegrate in the long run. What's going on with this, and what's the consequence of this?
So it looks like every face that's transplanted has so much tissue, so much material, that it's very hard to control the body's attacks on it because it's coming from somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to use all these powerful drugs called immunosuppressives, and they're nasty. They're not nice to your kidneys. They're not nice to your heart, and that's where we got into that. This could shorten your life if you got a face transplant. But if you don't use big enough doses, then the body's going to reject the face. And if that face rejects, I'm telling you, you got two choices. They can pull a flap of skin up from your leg and try to lay it over your head, literally, or you're going to die. And when we talked about the procedure here, we were thinking more about what if it failed on the table, but we do have an exit strategy. And I'll tell you, I think the person is very likely to say, don't treat me, don't do anything, let me die, and we're going to push the morphine into that person as fast as possible. If you want to say we're going to help them die, I'm okay with that, but we're going to make sure that there's no suffering, and I doubt we're going to try and keep somebody alive who says they don't want to go on.
So if this is if the direction that the story suggests that we're going in is there's a high percentage of these that are failing, I don't know if failing is the proper terminology, does that mean the likelihood of these not happening going forward is not so far away?
Yeah. I mean, it would stop everything in its tracks.
Yeah.
The places that have them are, I think, Baltimore and Hopkins, us, and I think there's a group at Harvard, and that's kind of – and then some in Europe. But it's not a huge number. But if they started to really fail after 2 or 3 years, the thing will come to a grinding halt. This is interesting, too, because there was just a story out that surgeons in Hopkins were thinking about attempting to try a penile transplant.
Yeah, rather,
and that's
for soldiers
who get
particularly.
And – again, you can't have too many failures before you're just going to back away. As horrible as it is to not be able to do all those bodily functions, you can't be killing people.
You know, speaking of depressing, let's go right to the source. There's another, to me, and I hope to you, really depressing story. The Journal of the American Medical Association puts out this thing that residents, you know, young doctors in training, mm-hmm. the depression rate is roughly 33%. And I knew that was high, but I didn't know it was high until I read further to say the National Institute of Mental Health said that roughly 7% of U.S. adults have at least one major depressive episode. So the depression rate amongst
listening to this show, I'm sure.
The depression rate for residents is 5 times that of the typical adult. And they go on to say it, obviously, not that we need, I mean, we could figure this out, has an impact on the quality of the care they deliver to the patient. What's going to be done about this?
So I think medicine is no better than the general public at giving priority or paying attention to mental health. The general attitude is suck it up, get back in there, work some more hours. When I was a resident, I did it. Don't be a weenie. So that doesn't really help these problems of stress and tension and overwork and worry and so forth. I don't know what's causing all of it. It could be that we sort of select people who have highly competitive characteristics who want to do well, but maybe it comes at a mental health cost. I don't know that. I'm just saying could be. But we got to get in there and start to support the residents. You can't have a culture where all these young doctors are burning out, getting depressed. Some leave medicine. That's a huge waste of resources. You don't want that. Some put you at risk. You don't want that if they're for no reason. If they just don't go to work, that's trouble right away. So we're going to take this problem much more seriously than it is being taken. And by the way, the drug abuse and suicide rates ain't too good either.
You know, Jim wouldn't read this, and you probably don't either, Art, because they're known as the women's sports pages. Every Sunday, the New York Times style section does all the weddings, and they also do this thing called Modern Love. And the article this week was by a woman that was married to a physician and who had not yet completed his residency, or maybe he had, and she was talking about, anyway, the fact that you can be a widow for much of your life, even if you're married to a physician, because he's gone all the time. I thought we had dealt with some of this, that there were so many complaints about doctors not getting enough sleep and doctors, operating on like
the 80-hour work week.
Exactly.
Thing,
that we were not doing as much of that anymore. But apparently I was wrong.
Well, there's a backlash. So we did put in restrictions on resident hours, but some programs are finding ways to work around or ignore that, if you will. Some people argue that wasn't evidence-based, that the idea that if you stayed up or tried to sleep in the hospital, which you don't do very well, for 30 hours, that would not have an impact on you or the care you deliver, which I still find a little hard to believe. I mean, who wants the doctor that's been up for 30 hours? But there is pushback, and that's part of it. So people are looking to work around and try to get those longer shifts back. And some of it is in fields like surgery, orthopedics, where experience counts, and people say you just don't see enough cases if you're only working an eight-hour shift. Some of it is people say, well, it's still dangerous to have handoffs. And what they mean is a doctor comes in, they do their 8 hours, they give it to another doctor, and information doesn't transfer. Well, it's like a relay race. They're handing off the baton and it could get dropped. But in general, I think this, devote your life to medicine sort of thing without having a home life is dangerous. And you do see people starting to pick specialties that don't require that, like radiology or dermatology or allergy. They don't have emergencies. They can work a regular shift. And so some of the workforce is skewing into more lifestyle oriented specialties because they don't want that life. It's not necessarily good for us because, well, there certainly can be many people with allergies. You want to have a few general surgeons around, too.
We're talking about a medical ethicist, Art at Kaplan, so I guess watch out. Your doctor's awake if you have to go into the hospital anytime soon. But this next story, we talk a lot about the cost of drugs and sort of the influence of money in politics, the contribution to politics. This was the Globe,
actually.
The New York Times. It's not the New York Times. It's Stat News, the Globe's new business section, talking about this very
By the way, little plug, and I'm neutral. That Stat News feature is really interesting. They're
doing good.
A good job there.
Yeah, oh, terrific. Yeah. Oh, terrific.
They're focusing on health and science and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I'm watching it. It's good. It's very interesting.
Well, they've got a really good one today talking about these congresspeople and senators who have all this money invested in pharmaceutical companies and are voting on legislation that could make more money for their companies and then make more money for them, of course, because they get stocks. Tell us about this guy, Representative Christopher Collins. They really kind of nailed him.
Well, there's him, but there's a bunch of these guys that basically own stock in the companies they're trying to regulate, right? So you're basically saying, oh, the high prices on drugs. Gee, I have a big portfolio of drug companies, and I trade in them, by the way, while I'm legislating them. It's not off limits to do that. The whole thing is a moral cesspool. It's ridiculous.
Well, you know what? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
You've got to put yourself in I'll just say this. Those legislators, whether state or federal, I don't even know what the state situation is, but you've got to put your stuff in a blind trust and let somebody else handle the investing who isn't wired into your legislative efforts or non-efforts. to have it any other way makes no sense. Well, it makes sense if you want to.
You know that they could inside trade until a couple of years ago, till 60 Minutes, and then wasn't it Scott Brown?
That was a great piece of legislation by Scott Brown. But, you know, we should point out that as in so many other situations, Congress has made themselves immune from the laws that affect other people.
Yes.
Because across most of the federal government, as this piece points out, employees have to recuse themselves from working on issues that could affect the value of their investments.
And they should here, too. There's not even, you know what? It's not even an issue. It's just a boondoggle. I mean, there's nothing to argue on the other side. What's the case for letting somebody trade as they legislate an industry? It's stupid.
I didn't know this, though. Was this widely known, or is this a bit of a...
No, I think they really found it out. I wasn't aware that they did it. I assumed everybody went into a blind trust.
Yeah.
You know, you take your stuff and hand it to your broker, your financial person, and say, I don't want to know what's going on in there. You handle it and see me in 8 years or whatever.
So one last thing. I'm going to end with on an upbeat. I hope you agree this is upbeat. You ever been to Franny's in Brooklyn?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Franny's is an Italian joint, for those who don't know. What they are doing, which I love, they are raising prices. I think it's $3 or something. And all of that money, I hope they're telling the truth, all that money is going to be earmarked to pay for health insurance for the cooks in their place, who they say they can't afford health insurance for. Now, I know there are a lot of cynics, like I usually am, and say, obviously, they're just lining their own pockets because they could have probably afforded to do it. But assuming it's legit, isn't that a wonderful surcharge in the world of surcharges, Art Kaplan?
I think so. I mean, at least it's looking out for worker interest. And, you know, people are thinking, well, I thought you could get Obamacare, but you still have to be able to pay something for it. And there are also probably people in that kitchen, I don't know this, but in some kitchens, let's say, who aren't legal. And so they want to cover them and they can still buy insurance, but they're afraid. So, yeah, I think it is a good thing. I think it's very good to look out for your workforce and take care of them. And I think it builds employee loyalty. I think it'll work to their advantage to do that.
I think you're just being nice to me. I can tell a hesitation in your voice, but I'm not going to take a chance of asking you a follow-up question, except to say...
I occasionally get overwhelmed with the sentiment to be nice to you.
Oh, that's beautiful. So what's on the Everyday Ethics podcast this week, Art Kaplan?
Oh, you're going to like this.
What is
it? So back in June or July, I wrote a piece that said Donald Trump can legitimately be compared to Adolf Hitler. He is running on a racist demagogue thing. And I was just talking about his comments on Hispanics and Mexicans and basically said he's race baiting and it's not unfair to go to the Hitler analogy. And people went nuts and said, oh, you can't invoke Hitler. So I'm going back there and I'm going to say, yeah, you didn't like it when he was beating up Mexicans. You didn't like, how about no Muslims allowed in? You think that's far enough down the road of demagogic race baiting? Because I think the analogy holds.
Well, wait a second. Didn't you hear, was it George Stephanopolis, somebody in the last 36 hours?
Who asked him, being compared to Hitler? And he said no.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't hear that.
Yeah. And then
all right, I withdraw that.
And then his ex-wife claimed in their divorce, and you know, who knows, because there's a lot of acrimony in a divorce, but she claimed that he kept some of Hitler's speeches in a box next to their bed.
Oh, no way.
It was in Vanity Fair. You can check it out.
I think, all kidding aside, the media didn't jump fast enough to label this guy as a fascist demagogue who's racist. And that's where he is. And you know, I can't believe the party hasn't just said, if he's the candidate, we're not backing him. And any candidate who doesn't, you know, we've heard this said, but I agree. You don't back away from this guy. That's completely unacceptable.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. We had a discussion with our callers at the top of the show about why it is that the Republicans who are now condemning him, who are running for president, don't have the courage to go the next step and say, if he is the party's nominee, he will not be my nominee. But
exactly.
Art, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk to you.
I think even Cheney condemned him.
He did.
He did.
So if we're that far down the road, let's go.
Art, good to talk to you. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much, Art Kaplan.
Bye now.
Art joins us every week. He's the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center, also the co-host of what you just heard about, the Everyday Ethics Podcast, which should be a good one. Coming up, we're going to open up the lines and ask you about the return of BYOB, as in bring your own bottle to restaurants that don't serve liquor licenses. It seems to be happening in Boston and around the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The BYOB meal, that's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.